Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present author and activist Norman Solomon, who examines why the House Progressive Caucus repeatedly yields to Obama administration concessions made to the Tea Party-controlled GOP. Glenn Collins, an activist arrested in December during a direct action protest to stop construction of the Keystone XL pipeline in Texas, who talks about why he's working to build solidarity across the movement opposing the fossil fuel extraction industry. And Ava Golinger, editor-in-chief of Correo del Orinoco International, who discusses the reaction of opposition party leaders to Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez's incapacitation in Cuba following his cancer surgery there. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On January 12, 2010, Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, was hit by a massive earthquake that destroyed much of the city, including the National Palace, and killed over 220,000 people. The crisis prompted an outpouring of humanitarian aid, but 3 years later, over 350,000 people still live in resettlement camps with little hope for the future. Meanwhile, multilateral development agencies like the World Bank have invested millions of dollars in a posh hotel in Port-au-Prince, with luxury suites, 5 restaurants, and an art gallery. During the summer, large refugee camps in the capital were closed down as displaced families received $500 to move out. Now, residents of smaller camps are waiting in vain for their $500 payments. According to The Nation magazine, the U.S. Agency for International Development and the Inter-American Development Bank invested $220 million in a new industrial park in northern Haiti, an area that escaped major damage from the earthquake. So far, it has only attracted one tenant, a South Korean textile manufacturer that makes T-shirts for Walmart. This is typical of Haiti's post-earthquake development strategy promoted by the World Bank and Clinton Bush Fund. Foreign investment is funneled into projects that build low-wage garment factories in a free trade zone. Still, there is growing militancy among Haitian textile factory workers who recently walked off their jobs in a short-lived strike. These workers spend half of their wages on housing and transportation, leaving little money to build up a strike fund. According to The Nation magazine, 1/5 of all young children are in the care of nannies, babysitters, and in-home daycare workers. For generations, domestic workers, including elder caregivers and house cleaners, have been excluded from labor protections like the anti-discrimination laws, union bargaining rights, and Social Security benefits. Many domestic workers suffer from chronic injuries and are exposed to toxic chemicals. This is beginning to change, as New York State recently enacted a Domestic Workers' Bill of Rights, and other states like California, Illinois, and Massachusetts are debating similar measures. For millions of women, childcare allows them to go to work and support their families. The number of stay-at-home mothers has fallen dramatically in recent years to 5 million women, or 1 in 4 women in a married household. A recent study conducted by the National Domestic Workers Alliance of over 2,000 nannies, caregivers, and house cleaners found workers earned a median of $10 an hour. Live-in nannies made much less, $6.75 an hour, or $14,000 a year for full-time work. Today, domestic workers, mostly immigrant women, spend 60% of their paycheck on housing and often experience hunger. The survey found that as a group, 65% of domestic workers do not have health care insurance, and most workers felt that they could not risk rejecting extra work out of fear that they would lose their job. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the spiritual landscape in New England, shaped by Unitarians, Congregationalists, and Roman Catholics, is quickly changing. Conservative evangelical churches, many founded to serve new immigrant populations, have taken hold amidst growing secularism and an overall decline in church attendance. Over the last decade, the Southern Baptist Convention established nearly 120 new churches in northern New England. The convention is also opening a new Bible college in Bennington, Vermont, as the last mainline Protestant seminary closed its doors in Bangor, Maine. In Boston, over 100 Hispanic evangelical churches have opened since the 1970s, with many of the new churches conducting their services in Spanish, Portuguese, and Haitian Creole. Some progressive New England church congregations are upset by the aggressive and intolerant Christian evangelicals moving into their towns. Vermont Congregational Minister Reverend Emily Heath recently wrote in the Huffington Post, Don't come here telling us we are not really Christian, or spreading falsehoods about the state of our beloved churches, or calling our neighbors sinners. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Some of the feared consequences of going over the fiscal cliff were averted in the early hours of 2013, when the House and Senate agreed on legislation that increased taxes on families making more than $450,000 annually, while extending unemployment benefits, earned income tax credits, child tax credits, and tuition tax refunds. The deal, however, came without addressing future sequester budget cuts, raising the debt ceiling, or funding the government beyond March 27th. And while many progressive legislators complained about elements of the deal, such as limiting tax hikes on the wealthy while permanently taking $3.9 trillion in future revenue off the table, all but seven members of the 75-member House Progressive Caucus voted for the fiscal cliff tax bill. According to author and activist Norman Solomon, this is part of a pattern of behavior by Progressive Caucus leaders and members who routinely support concessions President Obama has made to the Tea Party-controlled GOP. Now, with uncertainty over whether the Republican-controlled House will raise the nation's debt ceiling, President Obama has vowed not to negotiate with what he describes as hostage takers in this fight. But given the president's record of surrender to past Republican demands, Mr. Obama has little credibility when it comes to standing by his pledges. The same holds true for the Progressive Caucus, which could, if it doesn't back down, be in a position to block any future Obama concessions on benefit cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Your reporter spoke with Norman Solomon, a primary candidate who fell less than 200 votes short of competing for California's 2nd District congressional seat in November's general election. Here, Solomon examines why the House Progressive Caucus repeatedly yields to Obama administration concessions made to the GOP, and how public pressure could reverse that pattern.
Well, this has become a very chronic pattern over the last 4 years, and I think less and less defensible. There is no longer the threat of Barack Obama being a one-term president. And so during the earlier abdications, you might say, or cave-ins, however you want to put it, at least there was that rationale that push comes to shove. It's important to back up Obama because the threat of a Republican president being elected in 2012 was real. It's no longer real. And so what we saw on New Year's Day of this year is a replication of a pattern that goes way back to 2009 when the health care reform debate was raging in Washington. And at one point in that year, in the early fall, the chairs of the 70-plus member Progressive Caucus, on behalf of the entire caucus, which is the largest one on Capitol Hill, composed of Democrats, sent a letter to President Obama saying that unless there was a, quote, robust, unquote, public option included in the health care bill, that those members of the Progressive Caucus would vote no. And in fact, by the early part of 2010, when health care legislation was passed by Congress, not only was there no robust public option in the bill, there was no public option at all. And yet, every single member of that Progressive Caucus voted for it. So, one of the big problems is if you promise something publicly or threaten something publicly, depending on how you look at it, then you got to go ahead and do it. And if you don't intend to follow through on your promise or threat, you shouldn't make that promise or threat to begin with. And we've seen this replicated most recently, 2 weeks ago, here as we speak in the middle of January 2013, on New Year's Day, members of the Progressive Caucus, with only seven of those 75 caucus members, voted against this fiscal deal that really backtracked on some major promises coming from the White House, including refusing to approve continuation of tax cuts for those over $250,000 a year.
Again, we have this discourse in our country where a lot of those who are commentators on politics in Washington talk about extremes on both sides and certainly cast aspersions at anybody who takes a principled stand on any issue. And basically, they'll accuse the right and left and the Democrats and the Republican Party as being mirror images of each other. And I'm wondering, how you respond to the idea that folks who stand on principle are somehow blocking progress.
Yeah, part of the problem is this sort of implicit assumption that there's something moderate about so-called moderates. When you have this threat to Social Security, when you have this tremendous military spending, when you have inaction on climate change, when you have the abrogation now under two administrations of basic civil liberties like habeas corpus, what is moderate about shredding the Bill of Rights, increasing the gaps between rich and poor, threatening those elderly and others who depend on Social Security with cuts even when they depend on Social Security to keep them out of poverty? That and so much more indicates that so-called moderate or centrist politics are not moderate in the sense that we would maintain or advance our humane values. And I think it's so important for us to reshuffle the deck and not simply internalize the language that the mass media throw at us.
Norman, in your view, what's at stake in the coming debt ceiling negotiations, where previously in talks, President Obama has actually offered increases in the eligibility age for Medicare and has more recently proposed something called change CPI, which in effect is a benefit cut for Social Security recipients over time. What should activists be doing here? What can activists do, and what's the urgency?
Well, I think it's crucial for activists and really anybody concerned about Social Security, Medicare, and spending priorities to insist that there must be not only no rise in the eligibility age for Medicare, but also that there be no cuts whatsoever in Social Security. The change CPI provision is an effort that President Obama has embraced and said he's willing to go with, which would cut the cost of living allowance for so many millions, tens of millions of recipients of Social Security. And Scott, I think of it similar to like the integrity of an egg. If you crack an egg, you have done something to its structural integrity. And in a similar way, if for the first time to whittle down Social Security benefits or raise Medicare eligibility age, this is really a Rubicon that politically and socially we need to make sure isn't crossed. I think now is the time, in January of 2013, to say to members of the Senate and the House representing us, no, we won't accept any of these cuts whatsoever.
That was activist and columnist Norman Solomon. He's the author of War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Find links to more articles written by Norman Solomon on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Activists fighting a plethora of fossil fuel projects in North America and beyond are increasingly coming together to present a united front against extractive industries that are destroying the land, water, and air quality. From mountaintop removal coal mining in Appalachia to the tar sands pipeline in Texas to hydraulic fracturing or fracking for natural gas, those concerned about climate change, public health, and property rights are supporting each other's struggles. 25-year-old activist Glenn Collins was arrested in December with two others during a nonviolent direct action protest in Texas, part of the Tar Sands blockade campaign to stop construction of the Keystone XL pipeline. When completed, the pipeline will bring highly polluting tar sands from Alberta, Canada, to refineries on the Texas Gulf Coast, most of it destined for export. Since 2005, Collins has been involved in the effort to stop mountaintop removal coal mining in Appalachia. He's part of the group Radical Action for Mountain People's Survival, or RAMPS, and has been working in West Virginia as a trainer and participant in direct action protests to close down mountaintop mining sites. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Collins, who explains why he got involved in the tar sands blockade action and his efforts to build solidarity across the various parts of the anti-extraction movement.
I went down to Texas, firstly, to help build solidarity like amongst extraction-based communities, and anti-extraction movements. I see a lot of parallels in between what TransCanada, the company building the pipeline, is doing, and the oil companies like the Valero that own the oil that's going to be going through the pipeline. And the I see a lot of parallels between them and the coal industry, and the intimidation tactics they use, and the abuse of the government and of the regulatory system that is done to kind of push their profit as a priority over like the kind of normal average people who live along the places where they extract or build their conveyances for their petrol fuels. So I went down there to most notably build solidarity and help organize against the pipeline. I ended up undertaking some direct action myself when me and some comrades of mine ended up going inside of the Keystone XL and barricading ourselves inside to hopefully stop work for quite a bit of time, as well as draw more attention to the cause and get more people involved in resisting the Keystone XL and resisting extraction-based industry everywhere. There were three of us who were barricaded inside of the pipe. We had a couple lock boxes in there with us, which are basically cement barrels that had concrete and pipes in them that we could lock to.
How were you treated by law enforcement or by employees from TransCanada after you occupied the pipeline?
Well, TransCanada workers pretty much completely ignored us, aside from a couple that filmed us. The police pretty much had no regard for our safety when it really comes down to it. Basically, they ended up getting us out by just pulling on the boxes we were locked to until the chain I had around my wrist that was keeping me in the pipe had broken. Luckily, it didn't injure me too severely. And then when we were taken into custody, the bail that was set for all of us was at $65,000 each, which prevented us from getting out of jail. It prevented me from getting out of jail for almost 3 weeks, and the other two spent pretty much a month inside.
Tell us a little about what the jail experience was like.
I was in a county jail. All the prisoners I was in there with were pretty amenable. There's generally not a lot of knowledge about the pipeline going around, but I had a lot of really good conversations. And I pretty much spent my entire time in a 60 by 25 foot area with 25 other people.
Glenn Collins, you described the action very matter-of-factly, but it was pretty risky, and you could have been injured more seriously or been treated even worse than you were by the authorities. What motivates you to do it?
Well, the reason why I took action against the Keystone XL and the reason why I take action against coal removal surface mines and why I take action against all extraction industry is one of them is definitely climate change and the, you know, almost unavoidable catastrophic events that are going to occur because of our effect on the planet. Also because of the effect that these industries have on the local communities and the less privileged populations around our country. This kind of profit over people, corporate greed, is a huge problem with our country, and I believe personally that it is a problem with the, you know, this kind of extraction mindset that our entire country has in relation to the earth and really in relation to each other. A lot of us learn in nursery rhymes and when we're young that to take without giving is wrong and irresponsible, and to kind of plow ahead without, you know, looking at your effect on your environment is, you know, innately wrong. So, yeah, the reason why I take these actions is to try to make the strongest I can with my body and try to encourage as many communities that have problems with extraction industry to not only take action too, but start to take these actions in unity with each other, because I personally believe that the only way we're going to have any sort of final victory against this type of industry, or really any industry at all that has these kind of effects on the community and the environment, is for us all to work together and to bring it into the extraction mentality that really makes our country a really bad place to live for quite a lot of people.
The tar sands are one thing and mountaintop removal is another. Then there's, you know, sort of the elephant in the room of fracking for natural gas all over the country. Are you also building alliances with people who are working against fracking?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Earlier this year, I was in Pennsylvania helping with actions against fracking, as well as people from RAMPS, including myself, have been to Ohio as well, helping doing action trainings and sharing information and networking to hopefully build a stronger anti-extraction movement.
What do you see as the role of government in preventing or enabling clean energy instead of fossil fuels to dominate our future?
Well, one of the biggest things the government can do is to stop supporting these extraction-based industries and their destruction of the environment and the destruction of impoverished communities. Stop giving tax breaks and incentives to these oil and coal and uranium mining companies. I think we've put in nearly enough energy and nearly enough time and thought into what localized sustainable energy can look like for America.
That was Glenn Collins, an organizer and trainer with the group Radical Action for Mountain People's Survival. Find more information on the anti-fossil fuels extraction movement on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After winning a hard-fought re-election campaign in October, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, recovering from his most recent cancer surgery in Cuba, was forced to miss his inauguration in Caracas on January 10th. Since being diagnosed with cancer in 2011, Chavez has undergone four surgeries. Although many details about the nature of Chavez's disease and condition aren't known, the latest cancer surgery in Havana left the populist president with a serious respiratory infection and other complications. Opposition parties in Venezuela charge that the current government, absent a sworn-in president, is operating outside the nation's constitution and have called for a new presidential election. However, Venezuela's Supreme Court ruled that the swearing-in ceremony could legally take place at a later date. Uncertainty about President Chavez's prognosis and ability to return to power has many observers inside and outside Venezuela speculating about who could fill the vacuum left by Chavez's absence. Before leaving for Cuba in December, Mr. Chavez designated his vice president, Nicolas Maduro, to run as his party's candidate should a new election become necessary. Your reporter spoke with Eva Golinger, a Venezuelan-American attorney, author of the best-selling book The Chavez Code, and editor-in-chief of Correo del Orinoco International. Here she discusses the reaction of opposition party leaders to Chavez's illness and the likelihood that Hugo Chavez's United Socialist Party and his Bolivarian Revolution can survive without him.
Opposition leaders, as well as a lot of the media, U.S. spokespeople, and many other critics, mainly of Chavez and of his administration, have been trying to say that there's a power vacuum in Venezuela, that there's no president, that there's just a complete void and absence of any government. But the truth is completely opposite of what they're saying, because not only is there a continuation of his administration, but there's also wide support regionally for the government that's still operating and functioning and active as normal. I mean, things are still proceeding. Policies are being enacted. Chavez delegated most of his sort of technical responsibilities to the vice president before he underwent this latest surgery. So, you know, budgets are being passed. I mean, things are taking place. The executive office is operating fully. And, of course, the Congress is operating fully and the courts and all the others. So, I mean, there's no issue in reality of any kind of absence of power in Venezuela. All of that seems to be a big media hype and an effort by the opposition to try to find yet another excuse to justify some type of coup or undemocratic overthrow of the Chavez administration.
There's been criticism over the years that Hugo Chavez has been in power in Venezuela, that he's really centered his United Socialist Party around himself, and that there's some concern that his socialist program can't survive without him, given that he is such at the center of things. What's the prognosis for that project to continue on without him if he is incapacitated or dies?
Well, there's no question that Chavez is a very powerful figure. He's very charismatic. He has a capacity to unify all kinds of organizations and sectors and parties and groups and people that maybe normally would not have been unified. That's been one of his strengths, and has what has really enabled him to be this powerful leader of Venezuela. Nonetheless, I think that this has been a process that has been going on for more than a decade of transformation in the country. People have had a major conscientious awakening. People have been very empowered in terms of understanding their role in government, their role in society, their role in the political process, in the economic process. And that's not something that's going to go away just because Chavez isn't there anymore, if that comes to happen in the near future. I think that over the past year that's been shown, I mean, Chavez was present in his presidential campaign, but not as much as he had been in previous years. And nonetheless, I mean, he had a sweeping victory. Right after that, when he was hospitalized, it was a week before regional elections took place for governors in the country, and he wasn't involved in the campaign for those governors at all, because throughout that entire time he was, you know, recovering from his own campaign and elections, and was feeling this new pain and complications that were taking place for which he needed the surgery. So he never went out and campaigned with any of the candidates for governor that were from his party or allied parties. Nonetheless, they won in 20 out of 23 states in the country. So, I mean, that was a clear showing of the fact that the party has grown very strong. It's a young party. It was just formed in 2007 and, you know, is really just coming to its own now. And this was one of the first sort of, I think, trials and tests for the party, was whether or not they would be able to have such a victory without the presence of Chavez. Everyone always said, oh, you got to have Chavez. You got to have Chavez for any of these candidates to be able to be elected. But that was just shown to not be true.
Before his recent surgery in Cuba, Hugo Chavez had named Vice President Nicolas Maduro as his heir apparent in terms of politics and running in his stead if President Chavez had to leave office. What's your assessment of Vice President Maduro as the potential new leader of Venezuela?
He is someone who has come from grassroots organizing. He's a union organizer. He's young. He's barely 50 years old. He has great capacity and unifying skills as well. No one could ever fill the shoes of President Chavez. That shouldn't be expected. He's a good mediator and negotiator. He has a very big heart. I know him. I've been his advisor on certain foreign policy for several years. He's been the foreign minister also since 2006. I think it's a very good choice. I think it's probably the best possible choice that Chavez could have made. Hopefully it won't come to that, but if it does come to that, then I think Nicolás is definitely the man, the right man for the job.
That was Ava Golinger, a Venezuelan-American attorney, author of the best-selling book The Chavez Code, Cracking U.S. Intervention in Venezuela, and editor-in-chief of Correo del Orinoco International. For more information and commentary on Hugo Chavez and Venezuelan politics, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.